Hi, I'm Al Majoros. I am a three-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. Today we're talking cooking with Rebecca Katz. She is the author of The Cancer Fighting Kitchen. She's also the culinary translator for the Commonweal Cancer Help Program in Marin County, California. How are you today, Rebecca?
I'm great, Mel. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited because a lot of people don't think of food as a big part of your cancer treatment. They just usually think about the drugs and then you have to worry about what you eat after you're done. And that's not the case.
Well, no, I think what we're finding more out more and more is that food really becomes a part of the healing arsenal when you're going through treatment. And it can help strengthen your immune system and certainly help just with the overall terrain of your body. In other words, it's like it helps create an inhospitable environment for cancer cells to grow, and there are a lot of foods that really help mitigate side effects. So all in all, food really can play a really important role during treatment as well as after.
Absolutely, and it's one of those things that we're, like you said, we're just finding out about now. But culinary translator, what does that mean?
Well, so I call myself a culinary translator because I'm sort of a hybrid. I'm a trained chef, but I also have a master's of science in nutrition. And oftentimes, people will have what I call culinary paralysis because of nutritional analysis. It's like they are so overwhelmed with the nutrition.
Right.
You know, and nutrition is science, and cooking is nourishment. And somebody has to take the science and turn it into tasty bites of yum. And basically, that's what I do. I take all that science and I turn it into a yummy, and notice I use the word yummy, plate of food that you would want to eat, because great taste and great nutrition cannot sit at opposite sides of the table.
That's true.
So if something is good for you, it has to really taste wonderful. Otherwise, you won't eat it.
You must have been at my house for dinner lately. So how did you get from your being the master of science in nutrition to decide that you want to help cancer patients?
Well, actually, I started as a chef, and the nutrition came later.
Okay.
So I started with the right side of my brain, and and I started cooking in Italy. Then I went to culinary school, but I did this later in my life. So I like to say I went to culinary school the same age Julia Child went to culinary school, so in my late 30s. And so I was a little bit too old to be a hardcore restaurant chef. I did it. I did my culinary boot camp.
Did you find that there weren't as many women in the program as men?
Well,
because of the time of the years that you were there?
Yeah.
Julia Child?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was going to culinary school, which was only 10 years ago.
Okay. It's not long ago.
Actually, no, longer than that, like 14 years ago. Yeah. But anyway, restaurant kitchens were dominated by men, for sure. And it's a place, it's an environment, it's like an emergency room, you know? So it's almost like you're on, it's culinary 911 all the time, 24-7. It's a great place as a chef to learn and grow. I mean, but to really do it for a long, long time. It's hard on your body. So.
Oh, yes. I used to serve, so yes,
you
I know.
You know. You know. I used to, too. So, you know, the front end and the back end of the house, and it's really quite a scene.
That's funny. But, the emergency room, I never thought about it like that. But, yeah, when people are yelling, you got to get this out now. Yep. Stat.
Yeah, and those tickets are coming up. Yeah. So, anyway, I was working in this restaurant in Northern California, and I got a phone call from the director of Commonweal's Cancer Help Program, and their chef was not able to do a retreat. And long story short, he said, "Can you come down and cook for this retreat. And, you know, where I went to culinary school in New York, I had heard about Common Wheel. I mean, it was, you know, if you were studying culinary arts in the, healing culinary arts, health supportive cooking, you knew about places like Common Wheel.
Right.
So,
how long ago was that?
That was probably about 10 years ago.
Oh, so you were really a renaissance. Common Wheel is really renaissance as far as food as medicine, as we were talking about before the show.
Wow. Oh, yeah. So I get this call, and I knew who they were, and I was like, oh, my gosh, because you don't get that call every day.
Right.
And so I marked myself off the schedule, and I drove down to Bolinas, California, which is where Common Wheel is, and I did my first Cancer Help Program retreat. And I have to say, when you go in, like, one of the things that I realized was that, you know, it's very different than restaurant cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to check all of that at the door when I walked in.
Right.
So having worked in a kitchen.
Yes.
And for all your listeners, there has to be a sense of calm when you're cooking in a retreat environment. Nobody wants the drama, you know? So I ended up finding it the most transformative experience and the most nourishing experience, truly. I felt like it was what I was meant to do.
Oh, wow.
I just had that. It was like the switch, the light bulb went off, and it was unbelievably rewarding. I should also say that about 6 months before the retreat, my father, who lives on the East Coast, had throat cancer, and he was going through radiation treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And I marked myself off the schedule again and got on an airplane. And at that point, he was going through radiation. And radiation of the neck area is particularly difficult, especially for my father, who says food is the platform of my life. So, and I had no roadmaps, so there weren't really any books or any guides or anything. And I had to really, really kind of stretch my culinary muscles to find out a way that I was going to make the food, one, feel good going down his throat, and two, turn on his taste buds.
Right, taste good. Did he have like the metallic taste in his mouth, or did he just lose sensation?
He lost a lot of sensation.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really get the metallic so much.
Right.
That's really
chemo.
More of a chemo thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he did lose sensation.
Oh, wow.
So my mom and I, it was like the test kitchen. I almost want to say it was like the Pillsbury, you know, test kitchens at 7928, you know, and that's where I got introduced to my Vitamix blender, and I started coming up with cashmere sweater soups for my dad. And, you know, and I would just blend, I don't know, how many different kinds of things into a soup to make it nutrient dense. So that was my personal connection, was taking my father, who was the biggest foodie that ever was, and you know, making him and helping him enjoy food again and keeping him nourished during treatment.
Because that's got to be hard if you're a foodie and then all of a sudden you lose your sense of taste.
Oh, it's incredibly difficult. And I have worked with, you know, I've worked with chefs who've actually, you know, had cancer and that have gone through chemotherapy and have had to try and find their taste buds again.
Oh,
and it's very, very, you know, it's, I think it's one of the things, it's very, very evasive.
Yes.
And I think one of the fascinating things about what I do in terms of working with people with cancer is I really believe that with a little finessing, if you can really turn people's taste buds on, which is not always the easiest thing, because when you're going through cancer, you're going through transient taste changes. So those taste buds are kind of, they're like it's like an electric board that's shorting. You know, some of the lights are on and some of them are off. And
oh, yeah, you don't have to tell me. Mm-hmm.
Right, so you know, right?
Yes.
So the trick is to get the food to hit as many of the taste buds that are on mm-hmm. as possible. So where I may be tasting at 85%,
right.
When you are going through chemo, you might have been tasting at 20%. Well, you know, 20% when you're not feeling great is not good enough.
Exactly.
You know, it's
yes.
not going to bring you to the table. So
And you know, that's probably why I didn't want to eat a lot when I was going through chemo, because I would be so hungry and then I would just eat something like pasta with chicken or whatever and I'd just be like, ugh.
Ew, there's no there.
Yeah. Well,
there's no,
where were you 3 years ago?
Right, where
sister?
Was I 3 years ago? Well, and so I came up with a system, which is really based, I have to say, I have to give the credit to my, you know, my great-grandmother, because, you know, it's what every good cook knows, really mm-hmm. balancing flavor. And
right.
I use the acronym FASS, F-A-S-S, which stands for fat, acid, salty, and sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if I were cooking for you and you said to me, you know, gosh, I had this terrible metallic taste in my mouth.
Oh, yes.
And I just, everything I eat makes me, you know, I don't want to eat it. And mm-hmm. I would say, well, if things taste a little bit metallic, we're going to add a little bit of grade B maple syrup.
Oh, sweet.
Or maybe we're going to add a squeeze of lemon. Or maybe I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make you a cashmere sweater soup, like a carrot ginger soup, and I'm going to add some cashew cream, you know, really blended, to coat those taste buds,
right.
You know, so that phantom metallic taste would go away. And
right.
then there's some people who say, you know what, everything tastes like cardboard. Nothing. And for somebody like that, I always suggest that they add more sea salt.
Oh, really?
So that the flavor of the dish moves forward to the front of the mouth, and then maybe a spritz of fresh lemon juice to bring out even more of the flavors of food. So these things, fat, acid, salty, and sweet, are flavor carriers. And you know, so the more that you can coax out flavors and make the food dynamic and tasty,
yeah.
the more chance somebody who's eating, you know, eating the food is going to really feel nourished by it, you know. And that's kind of what, that is, I think, what gets overlooked a lot, you know. People don't really talk about transient taste changes, and they don't really talk about that, well, you know, if your food doesn't taste good, well, you know what? Too bad. Guess what?
Exactly.
You're living right now, you know. But hey, there's a quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And also, again, if we're going back to the very premise that, you know, the more nutrient-dense and flavorful foods that you can eat, which, by the way, are cancer-fighting,
right.
you know, it's just going to help you in your treatment. It's going to help you thrive. So I have to say, Mel, that for me, that idea of really creating big flavor taste and recipes that have big flavor to them and that are nutrient dense is just what challenges me.
And I bet it challenges, like, I know a lot of people, I didn't have this but just because I didn't want to, but a lot of people have their friends and neighbors make food for them.
Right.
And I think this book would be perfect for somebody like that, even if the patient said, here, I don't, you know, please don't make your lasagna because it's really good. But when I'm going through treatment, all the acidity just kills me. Here, try making something here out of this book so I can, you know, actually taste it and enjoy it and feel full and nourished.
Absolutely. You know, there's a whole chapter in the book about creating a culinary support team.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I say to caregivers and friends, sometimes the best thing you can do is cook something for somebody, but not a tuna noodle Mexicali bake, you know?
Yes.
Not necessarily, you know, the 10th lasagna that's going to land on your porch.
Or meatloaf or whatever.
Or meatloaf or something like that. But you know, if you can pull together, you know, if you can cook something that's really going to be nourishing, which might be from the Cancer Fighting Kitchen or my first book, One Bite at a Time, then you're really going to give somebody something that's nourishing and tastes good. And P.S., you're going to like it too.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So it's like it's food for everyone, but it's really super nourishing.
And the recipes are easy to make. Like my fiance doesn't really cook, and I could, well, kind of picture him, at least me helping him to make these recipes, because he's a more of a boil water kind of guy.
Well, at least he boils water.
Yeah, you know.
I got to tell you, that's more than my husband does.
Well, you're the chef. He doesn't have to do anything. So.
I get him to do the dishes.
There you go. There you go.
That's the thing. But I made them easy because, and I learned this actually along the way. Recipe writing is challenging, and it's hard for cooks.
Because I imagine you just know, you just go, oh, I'll take this and a pinch of that. And
I had to have somebody, I had my assistant.
Shadow you?
Stand with the computer by my stove.
That's hilarious. I can picture that.
It was hilarious. And she would say, you know, and what are you putting in? You didn't do that the last time I watched you make this recipe.
No.
And so I started with accuracy, and then I would fine-tune it. And then I would say, do I really have to make, how can I condense steps? You know, because the person that's going to be using this book either is going to be a caregiver or a friend or...
even the patient.
Or it's going to be somebody going through treatment.
Right.
And even if they are a fabulous cook, they're not going to feel like, you know, trying to figure out and do 12 different steps in the dishes.
Right.
So I really had to think, who is my audience? And I'll tell you something. It made me a better recipe writer as a result, because I had to constantly think of how am I going to condense. And then I had a colleague of mine who's just, she's so detail-oriented. She tested every recipe, and then the recipes went out to the community to test. So it was like, it was quite a, developing the recipes and writing the recipes and then testing the recipes again and again and again really, I think, helped and makes the book more user-friendly.
Well, if you need somebody to help out with that next time, just fly me out there and I'll help you out with the recipe testing.
You get right. You can stand by the stove with your computer.
Awesome. Give your assistant a rest. She'll be like, okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Mel. I'm taking a seat. So even some of these recipes here, if children are going through treatment or their parents, some of these recipes are so simple that the kids can help out as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it, like, for example, I mean, things like the smoothies and...
I've got the book open for the roasted red Roma tomato soup, which looks delicious.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Kids are great for the emerald green recipe, because everybody needs a sous chef to rip their chard or their kale. any of the green recipes, you get those little ones up on a stool ripping away, you know, ripping the chard or the kale off those fibrous stems.
And for people who don't know, a sous chef is basically like an assistant chef.
So. Right, the assistant. And you can put an apron on them. But for I have to say that a lot of parents who have children that are going through treatment, really, kids gravitate to those cashmere sweater soups, those creamy soups, the sweet potatoes.
Right. Explain why you call it cashmere sweater.
Oh, I call it cashmere because the soups are blended, and they're blended in a Vitamix blender. And a Vitamix blender, for those who do not know, is like the It's like the Ferrari of blenders. Mm-hmm. It's got a 450 RPM motor. And what that means is that an incredible amount of air gets whipped into the soup, and it creates this really smooth texture, like cashmere or silk or velvet, and without using dairy. And a lot of times when people are going through treatment, dairy doesn't necessarily agree with them. So I really wanted to not use dairy. I really only use cheese in the book. This is like a garnish, but I don't want to make it the main event. So if I have a blender and I can blend a soup into this really smooth and creamy texture, people get tricked, you know, and
yes.
think they're eating the most decadent thing ever. And it just, it's like, you know, it's like giving your taste buds a culinary hug. So, but anyway, even if you don't have a Vitamix, but you have a blender or you have an immersion blender, it's a great tool.
Right.
It's a great tool, especially when you have people who have swallowing issues or, you know, some people are just smooth and creamy people. You know, there's smooth and creamy people and there's crispy and crunchy people. And,
yes.
You know, some people when they're going through treatment, they want something more hearty, you know, that they can sink their teeth in, or maybe they want something crispy and crunchy and salty. You know, these are the things actually that are good to find out if you're cooking for somebody.
Right.
You know, are you a crispy or crunchy person? Or do you like your potatoes lumpy bumpy? Or do you like them mashed, smooth and creamy?
Right, because like we were talking before, I think a lot of people think, oh, well, I'll make my lasagna or meatloaf and they'll enjoy that, but they might not be able to eat it.
That's right.
Yeah. You know.
That's right. Or, you know, they might not be able. The other thing, too, Mel, that I think it's important for listeners to understand is that when sometimes what I advise is that people eat smaller portions more often.
Yes. That's what the nurse told me when I told her that I couldn't eat.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, if I were cooking for you, I might make soup and put it in small portion control containers that were like no more than 2 cups.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would put, you know, I would write on the other containers it was and the date I made it and put it in your freezer.
Right, because you'd have to hide them because the soup would be so good that I'd have to eat them.
Well, that would be a good thing. But better to present something in a smaller bowl.
Yes.
or even what I call soup shots. Like
like a ramekin size? Or
exactly, or just like a shot glass of soup, you know, a shooter.
Right.
Because that way, or like in a little demi-tasse, because that you can handle. You know,
yes.
Everybody can handle, like, 2 swallows of soup.
Yes.
And sometimes when people are just really feeling under the weather, I'd rather them have this continuous intravenous drip of yum, like every hour on the hour.
Yes.
Than nothing. So, small meals more often. And so, like, one of the real healing and the most nourishing recipes in the book is the magic mineral broth, which is really just a really nutrient dense broth. And I call it the chop and throw broth, because literally, you know, your fiance can boil water.
Yes.
This is the recipe for him.
Oh, excellent.
You literally chop the vegetables in huge chunks, skin and all, and throw them in the pot.
Oh.
And you fill it with water and you bring it to a boil and you let it simmer for like 2 hours. And then you strain it and it's full of potassium because I use sweet potatoes in the stock. So there's garlic and sweet potatoes and
yum.
This ingredient called kombu, which is...
I was just going to ask you that because I was looking in the book.
Kombu is a sea vegetable. It's a kelp.
Oh, okay.
And you can find it in the Asian section of the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
or an Asian market, but it looks like a piece of shoe leather and has the shelf life of about 200 years. But it's really, it's like dried seaweed you find, and it has tremendous amount of mineral content. And the reason why you want a broth like that when you're going through treatment, or even if you have the common cold, or even if you just want a nourishing broth, is because it's high, it's got a lot of potassium, and it's an electrolyte balancer.
Oh.
So when you're thinking about treatment, you can become dehydrated very easily.
Oh, yes.
And so you might not feel up to much, but most people, regardless of how they feel, can get that broth down.
Yes.
And that's a good thing. So I always recommend keeping magic mineral broth in 2-cup or 4-cup containers. And I use it in the book as the base of the stock for probably 14 or more recipes. Not to say that you have to make it to make the recipes. You don't.
Right.
But, you know, that is, I know people who like, you know, that's their big thing. They come to somebody's house with magic mineral broth. Either they can it or they, you know, freeze it and bring it. And it's something that is very welcomed and can get you through a really rough time.
It sounds like it. Now, how do you feel about knowing that you were on the cutting edge of food as medicine, as we were talking before? Like, you know, because at my hospital that I went to, and, you know, they're fantastic, but I actually had to ask to talk to a nutritionist. It wasn't part of, you know, your chemo teacher, like, okay, these are who you're going to see. You know, how do you feel that you're on the cutting edge, and now that you see more and more hospitals are using food as medicine as part of their, I guess, part of the whole cancer treatment?
Well, I have to say, it's incredibly rewarding to see this. I mean, what I love seeing is that it's becoming a part of the consciousness. And I started seeing a real shift because my first book came out in 2004, and really it was a tough sell to people.
Really?
Yeah. And then I did a second edition of that book in 2008. And it started picking up momentum. But when The Cancer Fighting Kitchen came out in 2009, people were all of a sudden much more receptive. And I think a lot of it has to do with there's more and more science that has come out. And it's, you know, it's like anything else. It's doctors needed to be shown.
Yes.
You know, there needed to be, you know, studies. And I think what now also patients are becoming more educated about food as medicine, and they'll go to their doctors and say, well, what should I be eating? And maybe doctors now will say you should eat a balanced diet, and a patient will be like, well, what exactly does that mean? You know, what does that translate to? But at least doctors aren't saying you should only eat white food. You know,
right.
Or, you know, so I think
that would be a big no-no if they said you should only eat white food.
That would be a big no-no, because we find that actually foods that are, you know, high in sugar and white flour and simple carbohydrates mess with your insulin levels. And when you're going through treatment, that's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's even more room for this to grow, but it's incredibly rewarding, I must say. But on the other hand, it makes me smile because, you know, food, good food, whole foods.
Yes.
It's not rocket science.
It's not. But it takes, you know, it's all about educating people. I mean, I know people who don't know how to read a nutrition label.
Yeah. And it's true. And I have to remind myself of that, too, mm-hmm. that, you know, I grew up with whole food,
right.
You know, I grew up with, you know, I grew up in a cooking family,
mm-hmm.
But not everybody does. I mean, there's a whole generation now of people that don't cook. They microwave, but 75% of the population right now doesn't cook.
Right. And processed foods are bad for you.
Yes.
I mean, everything in moderation, but if you have, you know, a microwave meal every night, then that's just not good.
It's not good. It's not. It's certainly not going to help you get through your treatment, you know. So, yeah, it's. I think we're on the right track with food becoming included in this whole circle of cancer treatment and of healing and I'm thrilled.
And survivorship and beyond, because that's the other thing. Sorry to interrupt, but it's like, you know, okay, well, I started eating healthy before I had cancer, and it's a lifestyle change, and you think it's going to be easy, but then once it's kind of hard, like just kind of cutting out the sweets and then cutting out the sugars, because I don't usually eat a lot of cookies or, you know, candy or whatever. I mean, we'll go to the store and I'll be like, do you want any cookies? I'm like, I don't eat that stuff unless it's like Christmas or whatever, you know.
Right, it's stuff. A treat.
It's a treat. And it's really a lifestyle change. And I think that's what's hard for some people is they're so used to eating, you know, the treats and mom would give you candy and cookies and cake. And, you know, you just have to change because it's your health. It's, as I say on the show a lot, there's only one you. And if you don't take the steps to keep you around, then who will?
Yes. And I think something else that I'm sure you realize too is that the one thing that you do have control over in this big trip, right, is what you put in your body.
Exactly.
And so, you know, that's the one thing when everything else can be so out of your control. It's nice to know that you can really effect change in, you know, how your cells are behaving by what you're eating.
That's true.
And that's empowering.
It is. It's very empowering. I know that's one of the things I call myself an empowered patient, because I don't think a lot of people think of themselves as such as far as patients go, because we as cancer survivors or just normal people, like you said, we have the power to change things. If you're in your doctor's office and you want to know more about nutrition, you have to ask if they don't bring it up.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the whole part of me calling myself an empowered patient and trying to get people to understand, like, your book and Food is Medicine. It's like, okay, well, if you want to know more about it, then you have to bring it up. Not everyone will have the information that you want at their fingertips, because they're not going to know what you want to know.
That's exactly right.
You know,
that's exactly right. And, you know, doctors are often concentrating on, you know, formulating.
Right.
And their brain is in a whole other space.
And the average doctor visit I hear is like 7 minutes.
Yeah.
So within that 7 minutes, if you have that, either you come prepared with a notebook and say, these are all the questions I have, or you just won't get the answers you need.
Yes.
Like I said, there's only one you. You have to make the determination to get yourself well and keep yourself well.
That's right. And certainly, you know, one thing that's part of the universal language is in this case, in terms of what I call sustainable nourishment,
yes,
is food. Mm-hmm. And that is a great place for people to start. You know, and as you said, it's a lifestyle change.
Yes.
But it's very rewarding.
Oh, it is.
It's very rewarding. It's rewarding to get behind the stove and to make simple things and realizing that you're in control of the ingredients, you know, and
yes,
that you can really make something that tastes great, you know, that you can do it. And you don't have to spend 3 days.
Right.
And it's really, I think, a part of what you're saying about being empowered on all different levels.
Yes. And just for our listeners, I know a lot of people, like, I'm a big fan of Top Chef. The recipes in this book are not like, you know, the things you see in their challenges or whatever. They're very easy to make. Like I said, kids could do it. Well, I mean, some people get intimidated by cookbooks.
You know what? I'm so glad that you brought that up. Because I'm sitting here thinking about, like, Top Chef and a lot of things that you see on food TV or, you know, these contests. And
And that's not reality.
It is not reality.
Because you know what? If my fiance finally cooked and he brought me like the little ramekin of food for dinner, I'd be like, seriously, you need to make me a steak or something with that, because that's just not enough.
That's,
you know, they're little sides. They're little tiny pieces for the chefs to eat. They're judges, you know.
You're right. But even like food is sport, you know.
Right.
I mean,
yes.
It's like when you're watching, you know, a lot of food television, it's like, you know, it's food is sport, or it's, you know,
I like that,
it's kind of like more of,
it's
you're
a spectator, right?
Yeah, you're a spectator. Mm-hmm. But when you're cooking, everything slows down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, time expands in the kitchen. And your friends can be in there. Your family can be in there. You know, it's much more leisurely. And, you know, it's not as complicated. You're not going to be.
Right. Tom Colicchio isn't going to be there with a timer.
Right. You know, it's not, you're not going to be running back and forth. It's not triaged. You know, it's not, I mean.
Well, even like you said, you worked in a kitchen and so did I. It's not like that in a kitchen either.
No, it's so not like that. You know, the only time when things get a little crazy in a kitchen is when you're in the middle of service.
Right.
Like, you know, when you're in the middle of a dinner rush, and that might be from, you know, 5:30 to 7:30, you know, mm-hmm. where things are, you know, everybody's kind of doing a dance. Everybody's in their station,
yes.
and they're working. Right. But nothing is as crazy as Iron Chef or Top Chef.
Right. Exactly.
Anywhere. That is like not the reality of cooking. But when you're in your kitchen and you're preparing and you're making a soup or whatever, that's the difference between that's where nourishment happens.
Right.
You know, that's like, you know, if you had a grandmother that cooked or a mother that cooked and everybody wanted to hang out in the kitchen,
yes.
because it was the place that smelled the best and where, you know, conversation was happening and stories were being exchanged and, mm-hmm. you know, you were swiping something, you know.
You were tasting this or tasting that,
or, you know, your kid is sitting up on the Formica counter, or, you know. But anyway, that's more the reality.
Right.
It's a happy place.
It is. And, you know, like I said, it's not Top Chef or, like you said, Iron Chef, where no one's going to time you. We're not sending, you know, if you buy the book, there's not going to be a kitchen timer to go along with it or anything.
No, it's what I call a non-threatening.
Exactly.
And the other thing that I would say is that The one thing that I did in writing this book and designing the design of the book is you can mm-hmm. really pick up the book anywhere. Like, let's say you're not a cook, but you want to learn more about the nutritional value of foods. You can
right.
go to the little culinary pharmacy and you can find out, you know, about how different herbs and spices work in your body to, you know, how they are what are called NF-kappa beta inhibitors, which, you know, basically help turn off the master switch that turns cancer cells on.
Oh.
You know, so you, all of a sudden, you know, you're like, oh, turmeric, or oh, cinnamon,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, and, you know, that's a healing thing, too, because you feel like, God, well, even I can sprinkle a half a teaspoon of cinnamon on my oatmeal.
Exactly.
You know, so, and also I talk to a lot of unbelievable healthcare providers in the field,
mm-hmm.
and they're all spattered like little dollops throughout the book. So there's little bites of information wherever you may pick up the book, whether you're a cook or whether you just want to, you know, be more informed.
Exactly. So this was awesome, Rebecca. So if someone wants to get a hold of you, how do they do that? I mean, we know we can get the book pretty much on Amazon or at your local bookstore, but...
Right. If people would like to get a hold of me,
mm-hmm.
my website is RebeccaKatz.com.
Excellent.
And my email is Rebecca@RebeccaKatz.com.
And the Cancer Fighting Kitchen, because I'm a Facebook junkie, it's also on Facebook, and you are as well.
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Rebecca. I think I might have to cook something out of the book tonight because you're making me hungry. Well, hold
on. Are your taste buds watering? Is your mouth watering? Do you feel inspired?
It is. Yes, it is. I mean, just the pictures in here alone, I mean, just inspire you to make, especially the orange ginger roasted chicken, which I just opened the book to. Now I'm getting really hungry. You know, not just making it for myself as a cancer survivor, but even just for a dinner party or something.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Absolutely. I mean, it's just really good food.
Yes.
And high in the factor.
Well, awesome, Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. This is The Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. Become a fan of the show, The Cancer Warrior, on EmpowerRadio.com. I have a brand new website, thecancerwarrior.net. And as always, life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.